Even when I was first started going to meetings, I was like, I'm worried about what people are going to think about what I share. That's why I'm not going to share and stuff. But then I came to a point where I was like, well, you know, I think it actually helps me just to get it out. Like, I'm not necessarily doing it for other people. You know, if people get something of it, that's great. But that's what sort of, you know, and then when I said, well, I can do that with music too. Like, I can just do songs that, like, I don't care if anyone likes them. I don't care if anyone listens to them. And then I just started writing a bunch of songs, and I was like, oh, I can do this. You know, like, I don't know why. I just felt like I couldn't. But that song is literally about sharing. It's about, like, it doesn't matter, like, if it's good or bad or how it sounds. I'm getting it out.
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
All right. Tonight on the Most High Show, we have a special guest, Andreas, and he's going to be playing his original song for the first time for everybody and our live audience. It's called It's Been a Day. Take it away.
Thank you.
Wonderwall.
I actually have a funny story about Wonderwall.
Why
I think we need to adjust your microphone. Yeah.
That was really good. I like that. I almost wanted to start saying, ooh, but then I'm like, don't do it. Don't. Don't.
Cool. Do we need to make sure the audio is still good? Any of the producers?
Check 1, 2. Check, check, check. Mic check.
So we do.
All good.
Right.
Oh, thank you.
Welcome to the Most High Show, made by and for people in recovery, a show about recovery, spirituality, and being human. Our mission is to provide impactful, community-driven media that informs, empowers, and inspires positive change. Real people, real stories, real life. This is the Most High Show. Well, clearly tonight's episode is a little bit different. We're like an official talk show and we have music. But joining us tonight, we have Andreas, who is not only just a talented musician, but someone who's been playing music for a long time, has had an entire second career, is in recovery, and is overall pretty cool. If you're not watching and you're just listening, he's got a cool style, and we're happy to have him here tonight. So thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for asking.
So, yeah, let's talk a little bit about the music, your story behind that. I think it's always cool to just learn about other musicians and their backstory and crowdsourcing their way into recovery and corporate America.
Yeah, that it did actually wind up being that way. So I, right out of high school, I spent the entire decade of the 90s as a professional starving musician. That's all I did. That was my identity. That's everything that I did. You know, I would hold, you know, jobs here and there. I was working like overnights at a hotel and stuff like that, working at restaurants and stuff. But that was my career path. That was all I did. Played a lot of music in various bands, did a lot of touring and stuff like that. And that was it. That was the whole deal. I didn't have any other plans or anything like that. Did a lot of touring like in the southeast and stuff like that. Put out a bunch of records and stuff. One of the bands I had had like, you know, some sort of like very mild success nationally, because back then, back in the days before the internet, or at least streaming music and stuff like that, getting played on college radio was like the big thing. And at one point, you know, I think there were several hundred stations that were playing us. We would go to New York, play like the CMJ Festival, which was a big thing for like indie rock and stuff like that. And that's basically all I did until my wife at the time got pregnant with our daughter. And so I had completely skipped going to college because I was a musician. I didn't need college. I grew up in Northern Virginia, right outside of Washington, D.C., and I'd moved to Atlanta because I had a bunch of friends who were going to Emory, and they needed a roommate. And so then I think I made the decision to move to Atlanta, and then like a week and a half later, I moved to Atlanta. I just kind of was like, oh, I'll just go there and just hang out for a little bit, and you know, maybe I'll stay like a year, 6 months, but I wound up just staying. And that was in 1992. So
yeah. That's the year I was born.
That really? Thanks for making me feel old.
Oh, sorry.
That was the year I turned 21. So if you guys want to do the math, that's how old I am.
I mean, I wasn't alive yet, if that helps. Oh.
Somehow it doesn't.
Man, I can't imagine why.
No, I'm kidding. No, but so what has happened is I was working in the Virginia Highlands here in Atlanta. And I was working the overnight at this kind of a seedy motel. And one of the guys that was staying there was worked at a digital marketing agency, and he was having his apartment fumigated. So he was staying at the hotel for the week, and I was the overnight guy. He would always come in late, pretty messed up now that I think about it. And so then one day he was like, he was checking out, and he's like, man, it's really cool hanging with you and talking to you. He's like, are you looking for another job? And I was like, yeah, you know, I've got a child on the way, so I got to start making money. And he goes, well, I work at this digital marketing agency. It's like an advertising agency, but it's like online stuff, and I think you'd be perfect for it. And I was like, A, I've never owned a computer, and B, I don't have a college degree or anything like that. And he's like, oh man, we're just hiring cool people, and you seem kind of smart. So just come in, you'll interview, I'll put in a good word, you'll get hired. And like, lo and behold, I got hired, and like, I had a day job. It was weird. It was like a salary job and everything. It was during the .com explosion, so they were literally hiring anyone off the streets.
So like a digital marketing agency in 1992.
Well, no, that would have been in 1999. No,
okay, I spent that's the when 90s. I was born.
Yeah. Just, oh, yeah. Cool.
I brought the dot-com boom with me.
Way to go.
Yeah, you're welcome for the job, by the way.
Sarah, dot-com boom Douglas.
What?
That's your name?
I like it.
Wait, so, okay. So it's 1999. Mm-hmm. Baby on the way. Working overnight at a hotel, mm-hmm. and then random guy, basically,
yeah,
is like, hey, I work at this digital marketing. Hey, I work at this brand new industry. Mm-hmm. You have no experience or a computer. We want you.
Yeah.
And then, okay, so what, how were you feeling at that point?
It was all a complete blur. And I should add that the guy liked to drink a lot. And like literally I got hired. And then I think like about a week later, he got fired for drinking on the job. So that was like, I was like, great, this is who they think I am and stuff like that. I wasn't drinking alcoholically back then. But no, I literally showed up my first day of work and they're like, okay, everybody turn on their computer. And I was like,
what does that mean?
I was like, and I'm like, I think this button turns the computer. Oh, it does. And then they're like, okay, open up a browser. And I'm like, what's a browser? And they're like, we hired you, you know?
I mean, did they interview you?
They did. They interviewed, but they were like, we'll teach you everything that you need to know. So they very, you know, very patiently were like, yeah, you know, I mean, I don't know if it's because they hired me for like cheap or anything like that, but no, I started working at a call center for a website provider and then just sort of got interested in a very niche part of digital marketing. This was, you know, it's very common now. But back then, search engine optimization was mm-hmm. like, it just wasn't a thing because everyone, you know. But I remember one day just talking to my boss, just saying, hey, you know what? Like, wouldn't it be cool if like, you know, the search engine, you know, AltaVista and Yahoo, all the ones that no one uses anymore. I was like, that's how old I am, by the way. Thank you for laughing about that. I was like, wouldn't it be cool if like whatever our clients do, like what if they came up on the first page? I think that would be cool. And they're like, yeah, go ahead and just do some research and stuff like that. So I became the SEO guy at this place. And then eventually the dot-com bubble burst and they started laying everyone off. And I was one of the casualties because it was the whole thing was just like, well, you know, he doesn't have a degree and he's like kind of a lower guy and stuff like that. So that was the first time I got laid off. But thankfully I got on with another agency and they were like, as soon as I got there, they fired everyone too, except they're like, we're only keeping the search engine optimization people because I had this boss at the time. He was like, he had the foresight to think, I think this is going to be huge soon. Mm-hmm. So we're going to just do that. And it turned out it became a pretty huge industry. And, you know, just out of sheer luck, I wound up being at the beginning of it and stuff.
Well, as soon as you said SEO, I was like, oh, no.
Yeah.
That's the bane of my existence.
You're welcome.
It became more complicated than just like, oh, yeah, make sure there's these keywords on the mm-hmm. webpage. It's like, let's look at the metadata of all the photos. And I'm like, you know what? Like,
yeah.
Props to you, man. That's not –
That's stuff that we'd figure out. I remember we would figure out certain places that Google's algorithm liked to look and stuff like that. And we were like, nobody's figured this out yet, you know. And so then our clients would have a lot of success. But then there just started being a lot more SEO people around and it became a lot more competitive.
And so how long were you doing SEO or if you're still doing SEO?
I did SEO until 2005. And then in 2005, I was like, well, everyone's doing SEO. And the company got sold. And they're like, hey, nothing's going to change, guys. Of course, everything changed. And so I jumped on with a web analytics provider. And so that was because I thought that was like, I think that's kind of going to be the new cool thing is web analytics. Like looking at all this stuff and seeing, you know, it was a really cool company that had a really unique way of doing web analytics. Because before it was just all data. But this software like put it all together and was like, oh, look, you know, here's easy ways you can read it and stuff like that. So I did that for a long time. And then they wanted me to move to California. I had a family. My son actually was just arriving around that time too. So I just stayed and then I started working at smaller agencies locally doing SEO and all sorts of search engine stuff.
And so are you still playing music in this time or are you just a career man?
I completely quit playing music. I didn't even play it at home or anything. I still had all my gear and stuff like that. I mean, for a while I tried to get back into it. And I did, but it was kind of like, you know, I definitely cannot do it full time like I was doing it before. You know, I can't record an album and then do a touring cycle and all that stuff like that because I had a day job. I had a real job. And I had, you know, two kids. So I was still playing it, but I mean, that it was definitely something that I missed a lot, because it's kind of one of those things where I was like, this is great. And I'm doing all the stuff that like a dad's supposed to do and stuff like that. But I was always like, you know, I was supposed to be a musician. I was supposed to be a big rock star and stuff like that. So that definitely played a part in my story, though.
Yeah, because it must have been like a drastic shift going from like really big, like on college radio and like just like being played on the radio at all, let alone hundreds of stations. And then to now being like, oh, have you heard of SEO?
Yeah, no, that's pretty much it. I mean, I would show up. I mean, even just the hours, it was a completely different existence, because I, you know, the hotel that I was working at for a couple of years before, you know, when I was, you know, doing the music thing, I worked midnight to 8 a.m. And then, like, you know, I remember my first week, they're like, okay, you got to be here at 8. And I was like, you know, it was pretty drastic.
I want to be off at 8. What do you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it was pretty drastic. It was definitely, you know, and that's, you know, I think I mentioned before too, like a big part of my story is like, I started feeling like these people don't know that I'm just like some random dude off the street who just lucked into this job and stuff. Because there were people there with like massive degrees and like all this stuff, and I was like, I'm just like this rock dude, and I just kind of like hanging out, and I just kind of know a little bit about SEO and stuff. So,
but you were good at your job.
I was pretty good at it. Yeah, I was really good at it. It also, like I said early on, it also helped that it was very much the Wild West, because it was like all experimentation, and it was like, you know, we would figure out something, you know, on a website or in the code or just something like that. But then like Google's algorithm would update and we're like, okay, let's completely change it. So there was like an art side to it. I always said it was like an art and a science. And I just, you know, I definitely, and it's funny too, because most of the people that I was doing it with at the time were also musicians. Kind of the same deal. We're like, hey, you know, we're not playing rock bands anymore. Let's just do SEO. So, but yeah, it was definitely a huge change, and just all around. And having a kid at that time too, my first child too, so that was different, you know.
Yeah, so did imposter syndrome like have a place in any of that, whether it was at work or at home or just life in general?
It definitely reared its head a lot at work, because one, I was still doing a lot of the SEO stuff. I guess my bosses were like, and it's funny because I found out later, it's like, well, you know, they would send me to speak at a lot of conferences and stuff like that, like in Los Angeles and Miami and a bunch of different places. And so I would go to these places, and, you know, and I think at one point my boss was, I was like, oh, this is so cool that you have this like confidence in me to do it and stuff. He's like, yeah, well, you seem like a pretty nice guy. He goes, and I'll tell you, you're like a minority, so like that looks good for us and stuff. And I was like, oh, so I'm like the mascot. Cool, you know. But then there was one that I was in Los Angeles, and I was about to go out there. There's like 400 or 500 people that had paid a lot of money to go and hear all these speakers, me included. And then, you know, the MC basically was like, okay, I don't see your bio stuff. Like, give me some stuff, 'cause we're about to head out there. And so he's like, well, you know, where'd you go to school? Where's your degree? And I just was like, I don't have a degree. He's like, what did you go to school for? I go, I didn't go to school. I didn't go to college. And he got really, really pissed. He's like, I'm about to send you out there with like a bunch of people. They paid a lot of money, and I'm going to have to, you know, and I have to, he basically got really, really pissed. I think that was the moment that it really kicked in. 'Cause I was like, he basically was like, I'll make something up about you. And I was like, all right. And ever since then I was like, you know, I hope people don't find out that like I don't have a degree and stuff like that. 'Cause I had a couple people working under me and stuff like that. And it was, you know, once the industry caught up to what we were doing, and, you know, the dot-com bubble was long burst, they were just starting to hire all these kids out of college and stuff like that. And they were, you know, so that became a pretty big deal to like have a degree and stuff like that, which is one of the reasons why I sort of pivoted over to web analytics. 'Cause that was like sort of like the new thing at the time. So I figured, you know, might as well get on the ground level of this.
And at what point did, because you mentioned when you were working at the hotel originally, you weren't drinking alcoholically yet.
Yes.
What point, like in that period of time, did the switch flip?
Even in high school, I mean, I definitely drank more than my friends, but it was never to excess. Like, you know, if we went to a party, I would always bring a six pack because I was like, okay, one beer is going to be for like a pal. One's going to be maybe for a girl who wants one. And then like, maybe I'll drink like three or four. once I got to Atlanta, I literally moved to Atlanta the week that I turned 21. And so that was like, oh, I can like go to bars and stuff like that and, you know, playing music and stuff like that. So that's, it definitely started getting, I had a girlfriend at the time and she was like, she was really into Captain Morgan's and Coke. And so I was like, oh, I don't drink hard liquor. That's gross, you know? And then one day she's like, oh, here, I'll make you one. So I was like, that's pretty good. You know, it's pretty, but then she would buy these giant bottles of Captain Morgan, like the really huge ones. And I remember
that's one day.
Yeah. And then one day she's like, has anyone other than you been drinking the Captain Morgan's? And I was like, why? What are you talking about? She's like, it's like almost gone. I'm like, okay. She's like, yeah, this usually lasts me like a month. And I was like, I don't know, you know, like I was literally like, I mean, did your roommate drink some of it and stuff like that? So that's when I think it's, I knew that I was like, ooh, this is, I'm not drinking normally.
So you didn't even like put two and two together. No, you were just like, drinking and yeah, like, this is how like, everyone drinks.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, well, this is what you're supposed to do with hard liquor, right? Like this much Captain Morgan's and this much Dr. Pepper,
no,
right?
Literally, that's exactly how my 21st birthday went. I remember someone made me a drink and it was Pepsi and rum because mm-hmm. the store didn't have Coke. Don't know why. Mm-hmm. And I was like, ew, this just tastes like Pepsi. And he was like, Yeah, it's a rum and Coke.
That was definitely a game changer when I was like, because I hated the taste of beer. I always had. But I mean, I'd never drank beer for the taste, so.
Right.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so, the switch flip. So this was, you said you had a girlfriend at the time. Mm-hmm. And so then when you're having, you have a wife and you have kids, is it still problematic at this point? Is anyone like, are you coping with the imposter syndrome with drinking? Like, what is the internals looking like?
I want to say that it was a little bit, and again, I'm dating myself here, but like a little before my 30th birthday. My 30th birthday, I was born September 12th. So my 30th birthday, I remember being really freaked out about turning 30. You know, because before I was like, I don't care, I'm going to turn 30, whatever. But then 30 really kind of got to me, and I was like, what am I doing with my life? You know, I was doing all this freak out stuff. And then like literally the day before my 30th birthday was 9/11 happened. And I was like, oh, my God, like, wow, that's insane. And I remember it very vividly. My daughter was like 1.5, 2 years old. I remember just looking at her playing in her room. We had a 3-bedroom tiny house in East Point, and looking at her going, wow, this is going to be like a totally different world for her. And it's going to be really different. And that just sort of, that definitely sort of, I mean, it wasn't necessarily like the actual attack that freaked me out, but it was, I was just really sad for my daughter. And I remember that definitely hung on me for a while. Mm. And yeah, it totally became, I got into the groove of like, well, I'm off work. You know, what do new, you know, fathers with day jobs and stuff do? They have a couple drinks to unwind and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I did that, you know, but then, you know, a few years later, I got the itch. I was like, I think I'm just going to start playing music again, you know? And so that's definitely, you know, the drinking definitely sort of started kicking off a little bit more after that. Because it was, the whole thing was like, I can't dedicate myself to this, something that I love so much. And, you know, seeing all these other bands, they're in the same position as I was before. They're like, oh, we don't have like real jobs. We just do music, you know, we're following our dreams and stuff like that. And I was like, I once had a dream, you know, and I was still, like I said, it was still one of those things where I just could not let go of the fact that I was not going to be a big rock star, you know? And I was like, I'm saddled here, you know, and it's great because I love my kids, you know, but it just was, it was a different mentality.
Yeah. I remember growing up, like, I had one friend, like, we were really involved in church, and my friend's dad was the worship leader for the youth group. Like, he worked IT. Like, that was his day job. He worked IT, and then he was, like, he was the worship pastor for youth group. But whenever we would go to their house, they had, like, this barn that was basically, like, a music studio. Mm-hmm. And I just remember the loud music. And, like, this guy, like, my friend's dad looks like Billy Joe Armstrong and has not aged a day since 2002, I swear. Like, and so anytime, like, I think of, you know, like, oh, hobbies and jobs that don't line up. Mm-hmm. To this day, I have not seen this family in over 10 years. Like, I still think of him because it's just like he found a way to balance it, provide for his family, do the thing he needed to do, and then still, you know, have, you know, and for him, it was like a physical building on his property where that was like still music. And I always thought like that was really cool, a cool way to merge it together.
It took a really long time to finally figure out that, because when I was playing music again, you know, I was still in the mentality of like, well, I wanted to be famous. You know, I'm doing this to be famous. I never sat there and just, because I mean, I I don't want to say like I'm pretty good at music, but like, you know, it just naturally came to me. I never had to take lessons or anything like that. I've played bass in bands. I played a lot of drums in bands and all that stuff sort of came to me. But I would never, music to me was not something that I enjoyed necessarily. Like, oh, I'm just going to like, you know, I'm just going to play music, you know, or anything like that. It was always like really wanting to be a musician and stuff like that. And it wasn't until long into sobriety where I was like, you know what? I can just play music just to play music. You know, I can sit there and write songs that I know that, you know, I don't care if anyone's going to ever listen to them and stuff like that. You know, like I never wrote songs until I got into recovery. I was always like, no, I can't. I'm a drummer. I'm a bass player and all my music sucks. And, you know, and this song sounds too much like this and I'm a fake. I'm a big fake. But I remember at one point during lockdown of the pandemic, I was like, I got that guitar that we were talking about earlier. And I was like, well, you know, maybe I'm going to learn to be a real guitarist because I don't really play guitar. And then I remember thinking, you know what, I'm just going to learn how to play an entire album on guitar. And so and then I'll just naturally learn something new, you know, because I can't go to a teacher because I don't read music or anything like that. So I started playing. There's this Bruce Springsteen album called Greetings from Asbury Park, which I think is awesome. So I'm like, OK, I'm going to learn how to play these songs and I'm going to learn how to play guitar. But like halfway through, I realized I was like, I have not learned anything because like I know all these chords already. I'm like, and then so that a switch sort of flipped. I was like, oh, well, maybe I'm a guitarist. Maybe I can write songs and stuff like that. Maybe I can, you know, just do it just to do it. And again, this was about 6 months into sobriety. And that song that I played was like, I think is literally the first song that I wrote. Like, and it was funny because I was like, what am I going to sing about? I was like, well, I don't want to sing about like love because that's just too much of a thing. And like everyone writes about love. But then I was like, well, you know what? Playing music is like sharing. It's like I'm getting something out. But the problem was before I was like, I was worried what everyone would think about. Like even when I was first started going to meetings, I was like, I'm worried about what people are going to think about like what I share. That's why I'm not going to share and stuff. But then I came to a point where I was like, well, you know, I think it actually helps me just to get it out. Like I'm not necessarily doing it for other people. You know, if people get something of it, that's great. But that's what sort of, you know, and then when I said, well, I can do that with music too. Like I can just do songs that like, I don't care if anyone likes them. I don't care if anyone listens to them. And then I just started writing a bunch of songs and I was like, oh, I can do this. You know, like, I don't know why I just felt like I couldn't, but that song is literally about sharing. It's about like, it doesn't matter like if it's good or bad or how it sounds, I'm getting it out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I love that because a lot of the times, you know, when you have a creative in sobriety, it's like the addiction fueled the creativity. Yeah. And so there's that fear to get sober because it's like, oh, I'm going to lose my spark. I'm going to lose my ability to be creative. I'm not going to be able to. Because during the lockdown, I too wrote music drunk on my parents' driveway. We don't play those songs today.
I actually have a funny story about that. You would think that like, because one thing when I was playing with bands in the 90s, I was always like, we are not going to get drunk before the show. We're professionals. We don't do that, you know, and stuff like that. And we stuck to that really well. I think I drank the least out of all of my bandmates at the time. And we were just like, no, we're professionals. We respect the art. You know, we're not going to do that. And I found that like, you know, when I was drunk, I would think that I was being more creative than I normally am.
Exactly.
But I'm not.
Same.
We were talking about that Oasis song. I remember at one point when my drinking was really bad, I remember I woke up in the morning. It was a blackout. And I was like, oh, my God, I just remembered. I recorded this great song that I wrote last night. And I remember thinking it's like the greatest song that it's ever been written. Mm-hmm. And so I played it and it was me playing guitar. And I was like, I think that's Wonderwall. Like, I think I just... Yeah, no. I was just playing Wonderwall over and over again, and I had in my mind written this song, and oh I was like, God. No, that's Wonderwall. That's not a song that I wrote. Funny.
No, there's a song I wrote. It was the first song I wrote the first time I got sober, and then the last time I played that song was blackout drunk, and I was like, couldn't even read the lyrics in front of me. The song was about sobriety and getting sober, and so it was. Yeah, I don't think about that song ever. But it's like when people are creative, right? And it's like, you know, the addiction fuels the creativity a lot of the times. And then, so there's that fear to get sober. And so like to hear the opposite where, you know, it was music was like kind of like its own algorithm mm-hmm. before. And then now it took sobriety for you to learn that you could do it just to do it.
Just do it just to do it. I mean, cause it's part of me. It's just the way that I get feelings out, you know? I mean, and that's an unfortunate sort of stereotype for creatives or anyone artistic is that, like, you know, they want to be like the cool drunk rock star and stuff like that. They
think
exactly. I mean, yeah. And it's weird. I mean, when I was playing music professionally and stuff like that, I never subscribed to that and stuff like that. But I mean, yeah, it's this weird thing where it's like, you know, oh, you know, the drugs make me. It's like I always say when people always like, well, you know, I play pool better when I'm drunk, mm-hmm. or they're like, I bowl better when I'm drunk and stuff. And I'm just like, no, you just don't give, you just don't care as much.
Yeah,
something nice about that. But at the same time, it's like you're not doing it better. You just don't care.
That's what I was going to say, because for me, it wasn't that I necessarily thought I was better. It was more so that drinking gave me the confidence to even put myself out there. I've never written music. I've probably written some BS on a piece of paper, you know, when I was drunk. But, you know, like dancing, for mm-hmm. example, like if I drank, I would be out on the dance floor because I was way too scared to do anything. I was too scared to like socialize mm-hmm. at some points. And so for me, substances just helped me at least just get out of my shell to even be funny, dance, mm-hmm. do karaoke. Like the first time I did karaoke sober, I was like, oh my God, I did it. Mm-hmm. I did it. Because I was like, I could never do anything without my friend alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, absolutely. I remember the very first time that I played a show in sobriety. Amazing lesson learned. I was playing a show at the Star Bar in Little Five Points, which is a really drinking place. But I remember, you know, even sharing it at meetings, like, you know, I'm going to play my first show in sobriety, you know, because I've got this newfound love for music and stuff. But I remember like freaking out, you know, I was a couple years into sobriety, and I remember freaking out going, oh my gosh, I'm about to go there. And I used to drink a lot there, like a lot. Mm. But you know, when someone offers me a drink, I'm going to have to tell them no. And then I'm going to have to tell them why. And then they're going to freak out. And then they're going to tell their friend. And then their friend's going to tell their friends. And then next thing you know, the entire night is going to be ruined for every single person in
because
that
you're
club.
Not drinking.
Because I'm not drinking. Because I've made it weird. Because I've made it weird. And so I built this all up in my head. And I get there. I walk in the front door, and not a minute into it, someone walks up and is like, Andreas, we haven't seen you in a while. Man, how's it going? I'm like, hey, you know, pretty good. And he goes, hey, let's catch up. Let me buy you a beer. And I was like, oh, here we go. I'm about to destroy the entire night. I'm going to ruin it for everyone.
He collapses to his knees.
I'm just like, this is it. But I'm like, I'm going to have the courage to do it, you know? And so then I go, no, I'm good. And then the guy goes, cool. So how are your kids? And I was like, what? You know, and basically in that second, I was like, I am still a completely self-centered jerk, man. I'm like, I literally thought that I was going, just the fact that I didn't drink, I was going to ruin the entire evening for every single person in that place. And there was a couple hundred people in there. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm still completely self-centered and stuff like that. Then at the end of that show, again, I was looking around. I was like, wow, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of drunk people here. And I was mm-hmm. like, I guess the pandemic, you know, I guess people are just drinking less, you know, and maybe it's an older crowd and, you know, maybe, hey, you know what? Maybe the world's coming around to the fact that you don't need alcohol. And I'm thinking of all these things. But then I see, because everyone was behaving like normal people and stuff like that. And I was like, that's weird. You know, because every time that I'm here, everyone's completely crazy and messed up and stuff like that. But then I see a guy in the corner just sloppy drunk, like on his friends, like screaming, woo. And then another like epiphany I had, I was like, people weren't as drunk as I thought they were. It was me. I was that dude. And it was really eye opening. And like I said, it was just when, you know, and again, it was just a lesson that I learned like well into sobriety.
It's always fun to remember that normal people don't care if you drink or not.
No,
like
it's
it literally
exactly correct.
Doesn't matter. Yeah. But yeah, like the call
is
coming from inside the house.
Normal people don't analyze anything to that extent when it comes to drinking.
Yeah,
yeah. I had a similar experience. My sister, I was like, man, this. I remember, I was after it's just going into 2024 after New Year's. And I'm like, man, we were all so crazy last night. My sister goes, you were crazy. She goes, you took the door off the hinges crazy. Like, you were the only one. You were so out of control. She said, you went up to somebody's, she's like, so-and-so is pregnant, and you went up to them, and you offered to have a threesome with them after she gives birth. And I said,
well, that's the responsible
thing. I said, everybody is.
Like, how soon after?
I don't know. I said, but that's funny. She's like, it wasn't funny. I'm like, whoa.
Yeah, no, that's it. But here's the thing. You are probably like, oh my gosh, I'm so much funnier when I'm drunk.
Exactly. I always said, I want to do a podcast. I want to start a podcast. And I'd always, because of that liquid courage, mm-hmm. I'm like, we can be getting drunk in the park. Have you ever seen Drink Champs? They drink during the show. And I'm like, we should have a Drink Champ style show. Everything, because it's like, I do not have the courage to do that sober. So like, will somebody please do it with me? And will somebody get drunk with me and do it? Because that's the only way I could possibly do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's it. Like I said, you know, your inhibitions definitely go out the window.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, just like I said, but that's the funny part is that I've talked to people who said, oh yeah, you know, I play music better when I'm screwed up and stuff like that. And it's like, I've heard you messed up and it sounded pretty bad, you know, but you just didn't care at the time.
Yeah. The only thing I've done was I was drunk one time and I sang a song into my phone and I was like, that was good. And the next day I listened to it and I'm like, oh my God. Mm-hmm. And I deleted it.
Was it Wonderwall?
I don't know what it was. It was really sad. It was disgusting. I wish I still had it. I could play it tonight.
So let's fast forward a little bit to when you do get sober. Mm-hmm. What was that pivotal moment?
Ironically, it happened at the Star Bar as well. Because I had a lot of social anxiety in my waning days of drinking, where it got to the point where I could not leave. At first, I couldn't leave the house without drinking. Then it was I couldn't leave the basement without drinking even. Mm-hmm. So I remember we had a show at the Star Bar, which is ironic because that was my first gig and it was also my last gig from drinking. But we had a gig there and I remember sitting down on my couch with a bottle of vodka and I was like, I need this. I cannot leave this house because I had so much anxiety. And so I remember just drinking and then I had like a really, really, really scary, hardcore blackout to the point where I woke up the next morning and I was still sitting in the exact position that I remember being in the night before. And I thinking like, oh my gosh, I've missed the gig. I finally did it. I finally let drinking get in the way of my music and stuff like that. And I just felt like a lot of shame and stuff. And then I remember like, oh, I'm going to have to text, you know, my band and stuff like that. I let them down. So I pick up my phone and then I see some text messages and I see, you know, these text messages from people. And it's like, hey, saw you last night. Good seeing you last night. Good show. And I was like, that's weird. And then I'm like, I go on Facebook and I'm like, oh, why am I tagged pictures at the Star Bar? Oh. And I look and I'm like, that's me. And I had completely blacked out so hard that, I was living in Lawrenceville at the time. I literally got off my couch, drove to Little Five Points, did a sound check, had dinner, played a show, stayed, closed the place down apparently. And then the next morning wound up in the same exact spot. And I have no memory of the show whatsoever.
Wow.
So that was a couple months before I finally decided to do something about it. But that was a pretty big thing because I didn't think I blacked out and stuff like that. But it was really surreal, you know. I mean, it's always strange like when you see pictures of you like from when you were a kid or something, you're like, oh, I didn't know this picture existed. But I was like, I'm literally looking at pictures from last night and I'm wearing the same clothes and I'm like, I don't remember any of this.
And you said you still kept drinking after that.
Oh, yeah. For a few months after that.
After that happened, did you try to control it?
I did. I threats from my wife at the time, you know, it was definitely, just a lot of pressure from family and from friends. You know, they were just like, yeah, you know, it's bad. And so I'll only do it on the weekends, you know, like all that stuff. And it just, and it's weird though, because I will take it back even further. This is really strange, but I know the exact date that like, I think that I just crossed the line and then went into like my rock bottom. It was a very slow, long, slow rock bottom. It was 2011 actually, because, my grandmother had passed away. And very close to us, you know, grew up, she helped raise me and stuff like that. And I remember going to the airport. It was like 9 a.m, the day of the funeral. I'd flown in and I was with some family and they were like, I get in the car. It's like 9 a.m. It's like, okay, here, you know, here's a beer. Let's have one for the abuela. And I was like, no, I don't drink during the day. And like, that's like, you know, in my mind, I was like, that's what like alcoholics do. I don't do that. And that was one of those lines that I had set saying, I'm never going to do that. And as long as I don't do that, I'm not an alcoholic. But I remember going, well, you know, it is for my grandmother. And so got drunk that morning. And then like from then on, it was like, I broke my rule. So I'm just going to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, and that was, again, it was like this 8-year sort of from there. I mean, literally, and it was January 4th, 2011, which is weird. I know the exact date.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
And so when you do get sober, what year is that?
My sobriety date is July 27th, 2019.
Oh, yeah.
My dad came down to visit. He said, oh, I'm just going to visit you. But, you know, he told me later on, he's like, we thought you were going to die. So I've come down here to help your wife and your kids and to get you some help. So I was like, all right, well, I'll try like this IOP thing. I had no experience with treatment or anything like that. And so I would do that like 3 or 4 times a week. And it just totally didn't. I was still drinking a lot. It was weird. It was funny because it was like, I was almost to the point. I remember once they tested me and I'm like, yeah, I'm drinking. Like, what's the big deal? And they're like, you're supposed to be like in recovery. I'm like, oh, is that what this is? I thought this was just like to help me like not drink so much. I mean, that's how blind I was.
I had the same thought process when I went to treatment the first time.
Absolutely. And then, but that was an outpatient. But then I remember at one point they're like, oh, we're giving these, you know, these grants, or these scholarships or whatever to do like inpatient, like 28-day. And I immediately was like, oh, I think I need that. I think I need that because it wasn't because I wanted to quit drinking. It's because I wanted to get the hell away from everyone. And so I was literally like, this is going to be a 28-day vacation for me. Yeah, I'm not going to be able to drink, whatever, but at least I'm not going to have anyone breathing down my neck. And then, you know, I'll learn some things. And then when I get out, I'll be able to drink better. You know, I won't be an alcoholic anymore. But, you know, about halfway through, something clicked and I you know, that was definitely the last time I had a drink too. I mean, I totally did not plan on getting sober. It was just to appease other people and stuff. But then I think it got to the point where they, you know, I had enough counseling and stuff where it was like, oh, okay. The reason why I feel like crap is because I hate myself and I, it's me. It's being shitty, not anyone else. And that was a big breakthrough. And then I was like, okay, well, I'll try to stay sober this time for me because I've got 6 white chips and every one of those white chips is basically someone's name on it. First one was like, oh, it's for my kids. Oh, this one's for my daughter. This one's for my son. This is for my wife. This one's for my parents and stuff like that. And none of them worked until like, literally I was like, I probably should do this for myself. Cause it turns out that I was a lot more miserable than I actually thought I was.
Mm-hmm. I remember we've talked about this before that you would sit outside of meetings. You would drink.
Oh, that was back in 2011.
Oh,
because
you were like, oh,
part of that,
you guys have the problem, not me.
Well, no, exactly. Part of that was that later that year, again, I started day drinking and stuff like that. That's when it really started going downhill. I got a DUI. It's the only DUI that I got. And they're like, you have to go to meetings and stuff like that. So I would go to the Gwinnett room and I would literally sit there going in the parking lot of an AA clubhouse before an AA meeting. I was like, I am not an alcoholic. This is so stupid. I can't believe they're sending me here. And I'm going to do it. But if I'm going to do it, I'm going to need a drink. So I was like, I deserve to have this drink because I'm not an alcoholic. I'm going to go in there with a bunch of alcoholics. And so I would pound beer in the parking lot. And I would just go there and just fall asleep on the back row and stuff like that. Get my little paper signed. And that was it. And that was, I did that for, I don't know, maybe like a few weeks. But then I stopped going to meetings because I was like, as soon as I'm done, it's like, oh, I've fulfilled my obligation, so I'm out of here. And I didn't go back in until 2019.
Wow. And what was that like, you know, realizing that the problem was within as opposed to all these other people and the external situations that were causing the misery and drinking the way you were?
Honestly, I think a big part of it is the fact that like I had just enough time away from having it in my system that I was like, I was actually starting to kind of think. Like it was like this fog had sort of started to clear and I started feeling feelings. And, you know, I was like, well, I'm here. I might as well work on myself. And it was, you know, I remember the first week because there, you know, there's no television, no internet, no newspapers. I couldn't even bring in books. And I remember the first like week or so, I was like, man, this is horrible. Like, this is bad. I don't belong here. These people aren't like me. I'm not like them. And it sucks because I don't have anyone, you know, I can't read. I don't have my phone and stuff. And then one morning I woke up and I said the same thing to myself, but then I was like, wait, maybe this is actually good. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe this is awesome. I'm like, oh my gosh, I've got this like free pass where I can just like work on myself. Mm-hmm. And I started, and like, that was maybe a week into my 28-day stint. And it was like, and it's funny too, because I was so unfamiliar with treatment. I didn't know that 28 days was like not a long time. So I was like, I've got this opportunity and I can't squander it and stuff. So, but then I started meeting people who were like, yeah, you know, I've been sober living for like a year. And I'm like, what? That's weird, you know, but I made the best of those 28 days.
Mm-hmm. And what was like the transition coming home from that?
Well, I was upset that people didn't recognize that I was a completely different person after 2 months of not drinking. I was like, how dare you? You know, and I was like spouting out all the language and stuff like that. And it was definitely one of those things where it's like, you know, with my wife, who is my ex-wife now, I was seriously like, what you just said, like, you'd just be happy if you just stopped drinking. And I'm like, I stopped drinking like 58 days ago. Mm-hmm. Like, what's wrong with you? Why aren't you like, figuring this out? And again, that was just part of the self-centeredness where I was like, I was indignant. I was like, how dare you, you know? And it was, looking back, it's so cringeworthy.
That makes me think of the story in the book about the tornado, and the tornado passes through and it's like, look, Ma, like.
Exactly. And it's funny because that was someone led discussion at a meeting the other night. And that's the example that I shared. I was like, yeah, I was the tornado. And then I was like, oh, the tornado's gone. You know, I didn't see the damage. I just knew the tornado was gone. And I was just like, and I didn't realize that, you know, oh, I was the tornado. And maybe that, you know, maybe they don't let, you know, maybe it's going to take a while for them to get used to it and stuff like that. So I definitely had to learn patience, and that, you know, it was all part of the learning process of early sobriety. I mean, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's like a common thing, you know, people get sober, mm-hmm. and then like when they catch that momentum, they're like, I need to make everything right now. And like their family still doesn't want to talk to them.
Exactly.
And they don't get it. And then like, but it's like, you know, it legitimately pains people, right? Like, I definitely was not eager to make my amends, but you know, I've seen it where like they get crushed, mm-hmm. when their families aren't ready to talk to them.
Yep.
They're crushed that their people aren't just like welcoming them back with open arms. Mm-hmm. And so, like, as someone who's had that experience, like, what was that? How did you navigate that?
You know, it, like I said, I think people call it, it's like people, you want a parade because, you know, and but pretty early on, I would talk to, you know, sort of people who had time and stuff like that. And I remember, you know, I forgot what chip it was. It was definitely in the first year, but I was like, it was still like, oh my God, I can't believe I haven't drinking in 6 months or just something like that. And I was feeling pretty big and stuff like that. And I think I mentioned something about like, yeah, you know, my family's not coming around and stuff like that. And the guy asked, he's like, well, how long do you have? I go, I've got about 6 months. And he goes, well, congratulations on not being a piece of shit for 6 months. And I was like, that's a good point. I'm like, that is definitely, you know, I was thinking that it was that shallow. It was just that like, oh, I stopped, so it's good now. It took a while. I mean, it definitely took a while. And it's still like, I'm still learning stuff every day. You know, I'm like 6.5 years in or so, but like, I still find myself like learning brand new things. You know?
Yeah. The first time I came home from treatment, my family greeted me with like a big welcome home basket and like a sign. And I was like, yay.
You did get a parade.
Yeah, I literally.
Well,
yeah.
But then when
Miss America.
So, yeah, I was like, I'm cured.
Yep.
And then when I kept drinking, I was like, oh my God, you're going to hate me. So I have to like really, like every time I'd relapse, I would hide it or whatever. But then I remember the second time when I did a longer stay and I got mm-hmm. home, I was like, okay, let's see. Because I missed my birthday. I was mm-hmm. like, what? I got nothing. And I was like, where's my stuff? Where's my basket? Where's my parade? Where's my birthday party? My surprise party? Mm-hmm. I got, they were like, we cleared out your apartment. Like, they weren't having it. And I remember feeling like, what the? But this time it's like for real. And
why would they believe you?
And yeah, mm-hmm. why would they?
That's exactly it. I was talking to someone, I think a newcomer the other day, and mentioned something similar. It's like, you know, because for a long time, I would say that, you know, no one in my family believed me. And why would they? You know, like especially my, you know, bless her heart, my ex-wife, it was like, I would always say, yeah, I'm going to change. I promise you, and stuff like that. And I did that for, you know, I would say at least a good solid 10 years where, you know, my drinking was problematic and stuff like that. And she started saying, you're an alcoholic. And I was like, oh, I'm going to change. I swear this time I will, and stuff like that. And, you know, even to this day, I'm just like, I am not surprised that people don't believe me, because why would they? I mean, 6 years is nothing compared to just the absolute wreckage that I left in the past. So I used to get really mad at it. I used to get really mad when people were like, oh, really? But like, you sometimes drink and stuff like that. I'm like, how dare you? You know, I've got 2 years. You know, but now it's like, I can relate. I can literally relate and just like, yeah, I wouldn't believe me either.
Yeah. And were there any relationships that didn't bounce back?
Well, I mean, like I mentioned, I have an ex-wife now.
Yeah.
But that was definitely something that was a long time coming. And, you know, and it's funny. This is another one of those times where I just totally thought I was like the center of the world and stuff like that. I remember, you know, the day that, because I always talk about intentions versus actions. Mm. And so for a very long time, we intended to get divorced, but no one ever took any action. It was, and I relate that to my drinking. For a really long time, I intended to not drink. And I really, really wanted to not drink. And I had every intention, but somewhere along the way, I mistook the intention as me actually doing that. Like me actively like trying not to drink as opposed to. But no, it's just one of those things where, you know, a couple of years back, I was like, okay, you know what? I have to take some sort of action, because this isn't, it just has to happen. You know, I know it, she knew it, and stuff like that. But in a case of like, you know, I thought I would not show my kids even like the dark side of stuff like that. I remember calling my son who was at college, and I said, you know, I've got something pretty serious I got to talk to you about. And he's like, okay, what's going on? You know? So I drove up to where he, like about an hour away where he's going to college. And I was like, you know, this is going to be hard for you to hear, but, this time your mom and I are really we're going to do it. We're going to get divorced. And I was like expecting him to be like, no, you know, but he literally goes, finally.
Yeah.
He's like, oh my gosh. Uh-huh. Like I was talking to my sister about it just the other day. We're like, when is that going to happen? You know, and that is very much like what, you know, when I was newly into sobriety, when I was like thinking I was Mr. Sobriety, you know, I'd tell friends and family, I was like, listen, I don't know if you guys know this, but like, I'm an alcoholic. And the reaction was always like, oh, we knew, like, we totally knew, you know, and I was like, really? But no, it's some of the relationships, you know, definitely, I don't know, it's definitely, I say the serenity prayer a lot, you know, the relationship with my kids is, you know, is still quite fraught, you know, with my daughter a little bit more, just simply because she went to college before I got sober and she lives in Los Angeles now. And so that's, you know, that I saw her over the Christmas break and that was great and stuff like that. With my son, it's a little bit better. I mean, because he's a dude, I'm a dude, you know, and my first 4 years of sobriety were his years in high school and stuff. So he's seen me. He's got a lot more, you know, but I've gotten to the point where it's just like, again, the serenity prayer really hits, where it's like, you know, I can love my kids even if they don't seem, you know, even if they are mad at me and don't want anything to do with me, because for a while they didn't. But I knew that it was like, it's got to be all in their time. I have to have patience. I have to have acceptance and just like, you know, maybe, you know, a lot of hope. And then, you know, hope eventually turns into faith that things will get better and stuff. But it's been, you know, it's been tough. But again, you know, I can't expect to make up or undo, you know, years. They're, you know, they're big chunks of their life, you know, knowing that I was drinking a lot and I just, you know, doing all the things that come along with it. Mm-hmm. So that's tough. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I have enough faith in them because I know, you know, I know my kids pretty well. I think, you know, eventually they will come around and I'm just going to have patience and I'm going to give them the freedom. I love them very much. So I'm just like, I'm going to love them from a distance because maybe that's what they may or may not want, but I'm going to love them regardless. And I think someday they'll come around and we'll have a much more normal, you know, like kid parent deal. But that's up to them. I love them enough to let them feel what they feel, mm-hmm. you know, even if it's something that I don't like to hear, mm-hmm. you know, they're their own people. They've got their own experience and, you know, I just got to let them be them. And if that means maybe them not wanting to, you know, spend a lot of time with me, you know, then so be it.
Yeah. Wow. That was beautiful. It is my kids are young, but mm-hmm. my mom would tell me, she's like, when you were gone, Blaze would sit at the top of the stairs, my youngest, and he would cry and cry. And he'd be like, my mommy doesn't mm-hmm. want me. And I was like, when I first moved home, he would freak out when I would leave to go to meetings. Please don't leave and please don't, you know, because when I went to treatment, bye, see you later. I just mm-hmm. didn't come back for 3 weeks. It wasn't even planned. And so he had like that trauma. And I remember feeling frustrated. I was like, oh my God, I'll be right back. Stop. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, that's not fair. Because it's like on his time. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to like, oh my God, I have to like rebuild trust with a 4-year-old. I have to like prove myself. Because like my other son is a little bit older, so he'd mm-hmm. be like, oh, you know, he'd like comfort him. Like, she's going to be right back. She's going to a meeting. She'll be right back. Mm-hmm. And he would comfort him. But yeah, I had to like rebuild and I was on their time. And I had to realize like, yeah. I cannot be getting frustrated with them. Because I fucked up. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is such an important component to sobriety is patience. Patience, because when I first came in, I would see on the wall the promises, and I would immediately be like, that is bullshit. That's not really going to happen. Like, that's...
Not to me.
And then...
Can't be me.
Wait, exactly. But so then eventually, like, after some time, after a few months and stuff like that, I was like, that is such... Okay, maybe that one's...
Yeah.
That's weird. That one's kind of coming true. And then, like, after a while, it was like... And literally, over the course of time, I would look over and just go, I wasn't really trying to make the promises come true. Like, you know, knowingly saying, I'm going to do that promise and make that happen. But then I was like... I think they're coming true for me though. That's really weird. And I wasn't really trying. It was just, you know, just sticking around and just by osmosis, I was like, wow, life does get better, even though maybe I don't feel it. You know, it's not super apparent. So it's not a drastic change. It's not a quick change. Patience.
Yeah. And I think that's like a great expression of love mm-hmm. is, you know, you get to just live how you need to, mm-hmm. how you want to. Because I think like when, you know, I'm taking someone through the steps and they get to their amends, right? Mm-hmm. So many like first draft amends letters I read is like, you know, apologizing and then how they're going to make it right. Mm-hmm. I'm like, we got to step back. Mm-hmm. Like, because, you know, when we've hurt people, we don't get to decide how we hurt yep. them. Unless they told us how we hurt them, we don't, you know, we can't tell that to them. And then we also don't get to decide how we make it up to them. It's like, no, I hurt you. Mm-hmm. I did wrong. Is there a way I can make this right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes the answer is no. And we have to accept that, have to move on. You know, we still, you know, stay sober, mm-hmm. have to figure it out, you know, because they had to figure out everything we did to them that they mm-hmm. didn't ask for, that they didn't want, that, yeah. you know, they couldn't plan for. So I think it's a huge expression of love to just accept where your kids are at.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's, you know, even some of the people that like that just aren't in my life anymore that maybe I don't particularly like or anything like that. I definitely learned that, you know, like I think I heard early on too, saying like, well, you can love someone without actually liking them. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I've had to practice some of that sometimes. And I think that's what my, you know, I'm not going to speak for my kids, but I hope that that's what they like. They're like, maybe they don't like their dad right now, but you know, I think they love me. You know, I'm certain of it.
Oh, my kids have definitely felt that way towards me. Yeah. Yeah. Blaze tells me, I mean, I don't like you.
Yeah.
He's like, I love you, mommy. I don't like you right now. And I'll be like, okay.
He tells you that before?
He does. He's five now. Okay. He does. He says it to my mom. He says it to, yeah. He'll say, me no like you. And sometimes he'll, I'm like, Oh my God.
Well, I mean, I think that's an incredible notion, though, is this idea that, like, if you don't like someone, like, you know, I would sometimes feel guilt. I'm like, I don't really like this person, and, you know, blah, 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 and stuff like that. But it's cool that, like, again, that's just one of the things that I learned in recovery is that, like, it's such a weird, almost, like, it's a strange dichotomy. It's like, I can not like that person and think that they're kind of a dick, but, like, still have love for them?
Yeah, it's like, I'm mad at you. And so I just accept it. I'll be like, okay, you don't like me right now. That's fine.
Yeah.
And sort of, you know, my mom will be like, oh, if you don't like me, then I'm not going to, you know, and I'm like, it's not about like, oh, if you don't like me, I'm going to withhold. It's just like, you don't like me right now. That's cool. Yeah. And it's like, I get it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That's also like the beauty of sobriety and like doing the steps and working a program and the whole recovery journey is like, instead of me being like, oh, you don't like me? Well, I'm going to like, give me all your toy cars right now. I'm going to just start throwing stuff away if you don't like me. So it's like, okay, that's cool. Let's just take a break. Time out.
Yeah,
like, I mean, I love you.
That's practicing. That's also like acceptance, really. It's like, all right, well, you don't like me. That blows, but, you know, I accept that. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we come in for a close, is there anything that we didn't touch on that you wish we did?
No. I mean, I don't know. I think that pretty much covers it. I mean, that's a good question. I didn't think of anything.
Out of all the questions.
No, I mean, I think the only thing that I would, because one thing that I do now is I take a meeting into a 20-day recovery place and stuff like that. I mean, I'm always trying to tell, because a lot of people there are like, they're coming back. Some of them have never been to an AA meeting and stuff like that. So I found that I really like working with newcomers, like a whole lot. But it's just one of those things where it's like, if there's one important thing is that it's always like, just be patient. Like I was mentioning before, it's just, you have to be patient. You can't be, you know, someone, an old timer from the Gwinnett Room always says, she's like, you can't come in on Monday and be sober on Friday, you know, and you can't have this idea that just because I quit drinking yesterday, that means I'm sober. That just, you know, I always say that, like, you know, not drinking and abstinence isn't necessarily sobriety. For me, it isn't. Mm-hmm. That's just abstinence. That's not like, you know, the real work has to be on yourself. So, you know, if there's any newcomers or someone coming back, it's just like, just patience. It's just, it takes time. I mean, and the cool thing is that it is an unfolding. I'm still learning stuff. Jenna said something the other day at a meeting and I was just like, oh my gosh, I didn't think of that way. And it blew my mind. You know, and I've talked to people who just come into recovery like on their first day and they'll say something that they're scared about. And I'll just go, I have that fear right now. You know, like, that's crazy. And like I said, like the song that started off is just like, it's important to just let people in, share, have patience, and just get it off your chest, get it out there, get it out in the world and stuff like that. So,
yeah, right on.
Love that. Where can the audience find you to connect?
Oh, I have any like a social media presence. I mean, I'm on Instagram. It's Andreas.
And then do you have any music online?
I do. I don't have any music online right now. However, I am in this band that I recently joined. And it's funny because it's like a bunch of other like 50-year-old dudes and they're actually sober now too. But we do have an album coming out.
What's the name of the band?
The name of the band is The Meeks Family. I believe you're familiar with them. So that'll be coming out at some point this year. We're like in the mastering phase of that. And that's it, you know.
Awesome. Okay. Well, I'll go ahead and close us out. Make sure to check out the Most High Media app in the description box below on YouTube, where you will find this episode and previous episodes, as well as documentaries and more recovery-based original content. Find Most High Media on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. Make sure to like, follow, subscribe, all of the stuff, comment, share, etc., etc. This show is made possible from the Georgia Opioid Crisis Abatement Trust. Thank you, and thank you to our donors and sponsors. This has been the Most High Show.